These days, everyone who has a mobile device can take great photos and shoot videos, showing up all the time on Flickr, Instagram, Facebook, and a host of other social media sites. You point your phone and shoot a picture. Sometimes it's a hit, and many times it's a miss. So what separates the amateurs from the pros? For over 125 years, Dodd Camera has assisted photographers, both professional and amateur, with state-of-the-art cameras, lenses, lighting and darkroom equipment, and class instruction. You can learn about new equipment from their blog or attend one of the many in-store events. The folks at Dodd Camera are helpful, professional, and experienced. They'll take the time to answer your questions and give you advice you can use. You may go to doddcamera.com to find out more. And finally, we wish to thank Dodd Camera for sponsoring the Outspoken Cyclist podcast.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for March 31st, 2018. Happy holidays to everyone, and it's no April Fool's joke. We begin our show this week with a conversation about the Giro d'Italia with author Colin O'Brien. Colin's new book, The Beautiful Race, The Story of the Giro d'Italia, will be published in the U.S. on April 3rd. The Beautiful Race begins at the beginning, with the first Giro in 1909, and delves into the history of the country, the race, and many of the riders who traveled the often treacherous roads in stages that could extend up to 350 kilometers a day or more. Colin and I touch on a lot of subjects, including how Gino Bartali and Fausto Coppi, arguably two of the greatest cyclists of all times, were caught up in the war. Bartali smuggling papers for Jews needing to flee the country, and Coppi, who ended up spending most of those war-torn years as a prisoner of war. Did you know that a woman once rode the entire Giro? Indeed, she did in 1924. And we bring it right up to the current year as the Giro prepares to leave the continent and head for the Middle East for the first three stages in May. I want to preface this conversation with an apology for the sound quality of Colin's interview. We did as best we could with the Skype connection and my still expanding editing skills. So my second guest was unable to record this week as he came down with the flu. Rich Thompson is part of the Bike Alliance at William & Mary College in Virginia, and I think the organization and what they're doing on campus and off are both conversation worthy. I hope to have him on next week. My Hail Mary to round out the show was to go back to the archives and offer you my conversation with one of the greatest athletes in American history, Dr. Eric Heiden. The encore conversation is from way back in November 2010, and I hope you enjoy it. So let's head on over to Dublin to speak with author Colin O'Brien about his new book, The Beautiful Race, The Story of the Giro d'Italia. Hi, Colin. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Giro d'Italia is coming up, three-week race, one of the best races of the year. Good time to talk about your new book. And evidently, it was published to coincide sort of with the event. The Beautiful Race, The Story of the Giro d'Italia. I really enjoyed the book. And right at the beginning, you say that the race is the real attraction, and more than the teams or the riders, you tune in or turn up to see the Giro itself. So Before we dive into some of the chapters, how does the Giro, in your mind, differ from other stage events like the Tour de France or the Vuelta?
Well, I think I have more experience at the Tour than I do the Vuelta, but I think probably it's their individual charm that attracts people to cycling in general, and that every race is a little bit different. And it's something that even at the moment now, you know, we're deep into the classic season, and every weekend when you tune into the race, it's somewhere different, and there's a different style to it. There's a different personality. So I just think it's a, you know, one of the key attractions of cycling in general. But more specifically with the Giro, I just think there's so much history, so much of cycling centers around Italy, particularly northern Italy. And, you know, there's even the landscape is so dramatically different from north to south or from east to west that I think it just offers more possibilities than any other race.
Well, what I found really interesting about your book is it's not just about the race. It's the history of Italy, too, how the race sort of weaves through that history. Paint us a picture of the early Giro, 1909, and what was happening in and to the country at that time.
I think, you know, unless you have a strong background in history, it can be hard to think of a country like Italy, which, you know, now is, you know, one of the world's biggest economies, very modern. It's known for fashion, for design, for motorsports and these, you know, these kind of things. But at the turn of the century, it was a completely different place. It was a relatively new country, having just been unified a few decades prior. It was largely agrarian. The majority of the population was of the peasant class. The cities were very small. And, you know, even something as simple or something, you know, that we take for granted, like a bicycle, was seen as a technological marvel. So the Giro, and I think bike racing in general, came into people's lives as just this amazing symbol of the future and of, you know, of speed and freedom and the possibility to travel. Obviously, I think as well that the journalists were quite inventive in their coverage, if we can say that, in the opening years. And I just think there was so much romance around it, the sporting side of it, but also the technological side of it, because the majority of people following it at that time probably never went more than a few miles from where they were born.
Right. Travel was not easy in those days. That's very, very true. So one of the things that you say is that the Giro is both chaotic and capricious. Why is that?
Probably because it's a reflection of, you know, Italy as a whole. You know, having spent a large part of my life there, I can say that, you know, the country in general can be chaotic and capricious. And that's part of the charm, probably part of the frustration as well. But it, in the context of something like a bike race, it makes it interesting, because the one thing you can't do even nowadays in modern cycling is really have a cast iron plan for the Giro d'Italia in the same way that you can for the Tour. And I think that if you look at, you know, if you contrast the way in which Team Sky has been able to dominate the Tour versus their, you know, kind of lackluster attempts at the Giro, I think that says an awful lot about how difficult it can be to manage a race like the Giro. Because I think around every corner, whether it's the weather or the terrain or the fact that there's still more of a local character to the racing in general. So there's an awful lot of local Italian riders who want to do well on a, you know, a stage near their home or something like that. There's always a surprise waiting. And I think that's what makes the Giro so magical, so enjoyable to watch.
Yeah, well, we also love Italy, right?
Yeah, right.
France, and I mean, there's nothing wrong with France, but Italy does have some very specific charms. So historically, the races in Europe have been interrupted, I guess is the right word, by war, and Italy in general was also sort of under this fascist regime. How did that affect the Giro? I know they had to stop the race at one point. The first race was in 1909. So sort of just historically march us through a little bit of how war affected the event.
Well, it stopped for a few years during the First World War and then again during the Second. And I think it's hard to take it in isolation because I think particularly the period, you know, from when Benito Mussolini took over in the 1920s up until the end of World War II, and probably even the beginning of the, you know, the economic miracle, as they call the post-war recovery, it was something that it took over the entire country, you know, and there was massive modernization, but then, you know, there was also, it was a very difficult political time for many people who, let's say, didn't share the views of Mussolini and his party. I think that sport in Europe, I mean, in the world in general, has always been played a massive part in national identity and national pride. And I think the Giro was definitely employed in that sense by the fascists throughout the 30s. But, you know, so was soccer and a lot of other sports as well. Probably one of the big impacts it had was it robbed, or well, in the context of cycling, was that you had two of the sport's greatest ever athletes, Gino Bartali and Fausto Coppi, and the war period was really some of their best years, particularly Bartali, who was older. I suppose a lot of people wonder what we might have seen had the Giro continued, but they had pretty interesting interwar lives themselves. I think one was involved in the resistance effort and smuggled documents for Jewish families so that they could escape into southern Italy, which at the time was controlled by the Allies. And Coppi spent most of the war in a prisoner of war camp after being conscripted.
Yes. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, I'm speaking with Colin O'Brien. He's in Dublin right now. He wrote a book called The Beautiful Race. It is about to be published on April 3rd, which is a couple days from the day we're talking. It is the story of the Giro d'Italia. I get lucky and get advanced copies of books, and this is a really, really good one. I think your research has been very fruitful. We have done a show about Gino Bartali, and I have not done a show about Fausto Coppi. I think everybody knows who the two of them are. I guess I did not realize that Coppi was in a prisoner of war camp. I did know what Bartali did. Do you know more about that?
Yeah, I don't know how deeply you want to go into it, but he was captured by Allied soldiers shortly after being conscripted by the Italians, and then spent most of the war in a camp that I believe was in northern Africa. But again, it's a while since I've done that research, so I'd have to go back and check on my notes. I think, you know, he was given, at that stage, people had some idea of who he was, so I think he was given somewhat preferential treatment, but still, it's incredible to think that one of the 20th century's greatest athletes spent at least part of his life as a prisoner of war in a British war camp.
Yeah, that's pretty ugly when you think about it. There is something that I didn't know. Well, I didn't know a lot in reading the book, but in 1924. A woman, in fact, the only woman ever, rode in the Giro. What can you tell us about her and about that experience?
Yeah, her name was Alfonsina Strada, and she seemed like an interesting character. I mean, I think that since my book was published in Europe, somebody else has actually written an entire book on Alfonsina. I'm looking forward to reading it because she was pretty, I suppose, pretty iconic, and also you'd have to say pretty strange for somebody who, you know, in the 1920s, obviously society was a pretty rigid structure, and there were an awful lot of jobs, never mind sports, that that women couldn't do. But she got it into her head that she wanted to race bikes. She grew up in northern Italy near Modena, raced around, was by all accounts a bit of a tomboy from an early age. And basically was just quite good on the bike. I think she was able to, you know, she was able to hang with everybody, and she got it into her head that she wanted to ride the Giro, and that was that. I think the stories behind it differ, and again, I'm not an expert in her, but some people said, you know, that she dressed up as a man and she cropped her hair and kind of pulled the wool over everybody's eyes. But I think it's probably more likely to say that the organizers of the race were aware of what was going on and were quite happy to have her there, because she got an awful lot of attention and she sold, I think, a lot of papers, which the Giro, you know, is run by the Gazzetta dello Sport, which is one of Italy's biggest papers. So whatever was good for headlines was all right by them.
Finish that race?
Technically she did, but she had been disqualified about halfway through because she missed the time cut. But they allowed her to continue. So she, you know, there are reports of her arriving into town some way behind the rest of the group, but, you know, stopping and greeting all the fans and signing plenty of autographs. So she became a bit of a personality around Italy. And I think that she managed to, more so even than a lot of the male riders of her era, managed to keep some of that fame right up until she died in her late 60s.
Well, it's interesting that no other woman has sort of busted the peloton and tried to do that since. Or has there been another woman in the Giro?
I don't think so. No, I think it's quite a unique case. I mean, obviously the race was, the style of racing back then was very different. It wasn't quite as high octane as people would expect a bike race to be today. It was more about endurance and, you know, a threshold for pain and just kind of slogging it out over these incredibly long and arduous routes that were, you know, it was normal to have stages that were 300 or 400 kilometers, and most of it would be unpaved. The bicycles were pretty rudimentary things. So speed was less of a factor in the race than endurance, and obviously a little bit of good luck, because if you had a mechanical, you were in trouble. But no, I think as far as I'm aware, she's the only one who ever tried to infiltrate the male peloton.
That's pretty interesting. Can you stay with me, Colin? I'd like to take a real quick break.
Sure,
okay, and we'll be right back.
No problem.
You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Colin O'Brien. He's written a new book, The Beautiful Race, The Story of the Giro d'Italia. It's a really interesting book, especially if you like history. And it's not a boring history book. So I'm not a huge history buff usually, but this one's interesting, of course, because cycling weaves through the whole thing. You know, some of the things that are really interesting are the impressive stages. There were some stages that were just so different from what we think of today. And you were just sort of explaining what that's about. And then we have the names, Merckx and Pantani and Hinault and Roche. They're so familiar to all of us, but many of us didn't see a lot of us of the racing then, or we don't go back that far in being able to watch those races. When you look at the peloton today, how do the teams and riders approach racing differently? What do you see that has changed so much? Because you actually mentioned that.
I think it's become more systematic. So some of that is a consequence of money and, you know, better training methods, and also things like power meters allows people to be more, I suppose critics would say, robotic in their pursuit of racing. And I think that even going back to the late 80s, which was a, you know, kind of a golden era, it was more unpredictable, and the racing was more dynamic. I think it was possible for, you know, somebody like Andy Hampston, who was, you know, the first American to really make a big splash in Italy at the Giro d'Italia, and someone who's still famous in Italy because of it. It was possible for someone like him to really, to grab the spotlight and to do something really incredible in a way that I'm not sure would still be possible today.
Yeah, there's an awful lot going on with race radios and team support that you probably didn't have back then. You know, that you were kind of, they fired the gun and you were on your own. You know, you didn't, I mean, yeah, there were team cars eventually in the later years, but certainly not like today where everybody knows what's happening instantly. So there are no surprises like there might have been then.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, even another thing that was probably close to my heart being Irish was Stephen Roach's win in 87, which has come to be known the Zapata affair, when he basically went against the rest of his team and rode for the victory on his own, or well, with the support of just one of his friends within the team. Things like that are just hard to imagine in today's peloton, you know, that somebody that a co-leader in a team, or that, you know, a support rider in a team would go against somebody like Chris Froome or Vincenzo Nibali, or, you know, one of these top guys, and just strike out on their own. I think it would be almost unheard of. I would expect that to be shut down pretty quickly by the teams.
I want to change the topic a little bit away from the book, although I do want, toward the end of our conversation, to tell people how they can get a copy of the book. And I'm sure it will be one of those that will be a staple on any bicycle book collector's bookshelf. I want to talk about this monumental change that the Giro's first three stages will be taken off the continent over to the Middle East. And I know there's a lot of both controversy and hope, and I know that what the Israelis are hoping is that it shows that there's some peace out through sport. I've spoken with some people over there. What are your thoughts, and what are you hearing from other people on the continent?
It's difficult to say. I mean, I think overall you'd have to say that the reaction to it has been negative, because I think there are a lot of people who just can't allow themselves to square the idea of bringing, you know, one of the world's biggest sporting events to a country with a somewhat questionable human rights record. But my thoughts, and it would probably be that, you know, the cycling doesn't exist in a vacuum or in isolation. And this is something that, you know, the Soccer World Cup this year is going to Russia. After that, it's going to Qatar, which is probably a more questionable destination than anywhere else. These sporting events, they ultimately, you know, it's a great opportunity for the Giro to grow its audience and to reach out. I think there's an awful lot of positive things about Israel that hopefully the race is able to promote. And my thoughts on it are that, you know, if the Giro didn't do it, maybe the Tour would have, or the Vuelta would have. So I can't blame them really for taking the initiative and the opportunity to do something new and to bring something new to the sport. I think that the distance isn't really an issue anymore. We've seen a start in Northern Ireland a few years ago, and that was brilliant. Logistically a little bit of a nightmare, but everybody, you know, I think if the situation is right, and obviously if the money is right, but if the conditions are right, then I think they can make it work. And funnily enough, you know, even last year's opening stages going from Sardinia to Sicily, you can say that they're in Italy, but because they're both islands, and particularly Sardinia is quite isolated, it provided a pretty big logistical problem for the teams and the race organizer, and that's staying within the borders of Italy. So I think going abroad, some people are for it, some people are against it, based on, you know, the name of the race is obviously the Giro d'Italia, and a lot of people would like to see it stay in Italy. But I think that's just modern sports, modern cycling. It's normal that they want to expand and go to new markets. And you know, I think Israel is definitely going to be interesting.
I am hoping to be there. So that is a possibility. It is not a foregone conclusion yet.
Fingers crossed.
Just for the first three stages. And I was there in the fall. And I know there is some controversy about it and about everything that goes on. But I have to say that the cyclists, having ridden with some of the Israel Cycling Academy professional team, the people of Israel are very excited. And the route that they're taking is beyond spectacular. This going through this Negev desert is mind-blowing. So I hope the riders enjoy it. It's a lot of fun. I really appreciate you talking with me today. I really enjoyed the book. The book is The Beautiful Race, the story of the Giro d'Italia, Colin O'Brien. Its published date is April 3rd, which isn't yet today. It's from Pegasus Books. And is it going to be available like through the usual suspects, Amazon and that kind of thing? I know there are probably different editions for the U.S. than there are for Europe.
Yeah, it's available, I suppose, at the cliche, all good bookshops and, you know, the major outlets online. I checked some of the U.S. stores there just before we talked, and it's on there now, available to pre-order. So if anybody's looking for a new cycling book, I'd recommend.
Of course you would. You wrote it. It is an excellent, it is a really interesting book. I like the way you put it together. And I think anybody who is interested in both history and the history of cycling would enjoy it. Thank you so much for talking with me. Good luck. What's your next project? You have another project already? Probably. You're a writer.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Top secret.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll be waiting to hear. Thanks, Colin. Have a wonderful day.
Posted.
All right.
Thank you. Very kind.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Colin O'Brien joined me from Dublin to talk about the Giro and his new book. You can pre-order it today or pick it up beginning Tuesday, April 3rd here in the States. The title is The Beautiful Race, the story of the Giro d'Italia, and it was published by Pegasus Books. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to turn back the clock to November 20th of 2010 and my conversation with Dr. Eric Heiden. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and as promised, here is the encore presentation of my interview with Dr. Heiden from November 2010. Well, his name is Eric Heiden. In fact, it's Dr. Eric Heiden. Eric, thank you for taking time to talk with me on The Outspoken Cyclist. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
It is so much my pleasure. I am just thrilled to be able to talk to you. You have a pretty incredible history as an athlete. When did you actually start skating?
Well, it was one of those things that if I didn't skate, I was not going to be involved with a lot of family adventures. And they say I started when I was two. I don't remember it, but I can actually, you know, the first time I have memories of skating, it was at a very young age and out on the lake behind my grandparents' house.
And this was where, in Wisconsin?
In Wisconsin.
Yeah. So you are older than, you have a sister who also did some pretty cool stuff too, but you're the older one, right?
I am the older one.
And the cuter one, right, too. That's what we always say, my sister.
But I would tell you that I think a lot of people don't recognize how accomplished my sister is still as an athlete. She was a national record holder in running in the mile in high school.
Wow.
She was world champion at cycling and at skating. She was the NCAA cross-country ski champion, and within the last year, 2 years, was the Masters World Cross-Country Ski Champion. So she has done very well for herself as an athlete and continues to.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Well, you still hold some records yourself. You took home 5 Olympic golds in Lake Placid. That's pretty unheard of.
Yeah, I think, you know, there are certainly a bunch of athletes who in other sports have won more, and I think that there are skaters that have been around for a couple of Olympics who have walked away with more medals. I think like Apollo Ohno,
yeah,
I think has ultimately more medals than I have, but within the sport of speed skating, I'm the only one to come away with 5 at one games.
And you did long track speed skating. Is that what Apollo Ohno does too?
No, he
skates does short
track.
Right.
You know, so that's on the inside of a hockey rink. And what I did was skate on a rink that's about the size of a quarter-mile running track.
Aha. Aha. So much more endurance necessary there.
Well, I mean, they still skate the same distances. It's just, you know, they're racing in a pack, so there's a lot of strategy. And when I was racing, and the long track in general is basically racing against the clock. So it's almost like a
time trial.
Time trial, exactly.
Wow, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Do you remember being in Cleveland?
I remember being in Cleveland racing on a board track inside a very neat little auditorium.
Yep, I was there. I remember it was called Bike America.
Yeah, I remember racing for a couple nights in a row and falling down a couple times hard on that track.
That was a very steeply banked track. It was very, very short. And that track got stolen, by the way.
Ooh.
Yep, it was in 2 trucks, and somebody made off with the trucks, and gone it was. That was, you remember a guy, Mike Walden, I think his name was,
yeah,
from Michigan. Yeah. That was his track. Gone it was. Well, anyway, so when did you actually transition to cycling?
I really made a go of it after the 80 Olympics. I had been riding on a bicycle in the summertime for cross training with the speed skating, but after the skating was done, I felt it would be a nice opportunity to sort of, you know, see what my abilities were.
They were pretty good, as I remember.
Yeah, I had some nice opportunities. Racing with the 7-Eleven team was a lot of fun.
So in those days, the 7-Eleven team was a pretty special team. It was the first to go to the Tour de France, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah,
from the U.S.?
The goal of that team was to put together a team that could ultimately race in Europe and be competitive at some of the big races. And it was sort of the brainchild of Jim Okowitz. And Jim recruited myself and Tom Schuler to go down and talk with the 7-Eleven people. It was 7-Eleven at that time was owned by the Thompson brothers. And they were also being courted to support one of the venues at the 1984 Olympics, and they were going to help build the velodrome, and so as a consequence, I think they had some interest in cycling, and they bought on to our idea, and 5 years later, after the inception of the team, we were able to race in our first big tour, which was the Tour of Italy.
Very, very cool. So your sponsors, if they were involved in building the velodrome, it made sense for them to actually sponsor a team.
Correct.
Yeah, I get it now. Okay, very cool. So when you were riding and racing, the Peloton was different. How did teams work then, and how and why do you think it's changed so much now, or has it?
Oh, I think it's changed a lot. You know, and when we were racing to the Peloton, very few, if any, spoke English, and I think that has dramatically changed. I think most of the guys, the majority, probably speak some English and can converse in English. And back then, if you didn't know French or Italian, you were really sort of out of the loop. And then the other thing that I think has changed cycling dramatically and something that's sort of been a controversy over the last couple of years is the use of race radios. Back in my time, there were no race radios, and you had to be very aware of what was going on in the race, because a lot of the information that you would get would be significantly delayed, sometimes, you know, 20 minutes or maybe an hour. And so you had to be very aware of what was going on, and you could not rely on sort of race radios or any kind of communication that was really up to date.
So in those days, you had to wait for the motorcycle to come along or the team car to tell you what was going on up ahead or behind you?
Yeah, it was the motorcycle. There was somebody who had a chalkboard, and they would try to update you as often as they could, but sometimes there would be 20 minutes or 30 minutes between updates. And even the race, even the team director sometimes had not much more current information than you were getting from the guys on the motorcycle.
Well, you're the first person, and I've spoken with a lot of people who have raced in Europe and in the United States, you know, interviewing for the show here. You're the first person who's mentioned the radios as being so different. And, you know, and it never occurred to me. I mean, I used to watch Maynard Hirshon, you know, riding with the tour, and he'd talk about a lot of things. And, of course, he never talked about radios because there weren't any. Interesting. How about drugs? Talk to me about what was going on back when you were riding in the 80s as opposed to all this stuff we're putting up with right now?
Yeah, back in the 80s, I think people were doing drugs, and it was going on. And at that time, it was really using amphetamines, which are a stimulant,
right,
or using anabolic steroids. And at that time, there was testing. It certainly was not as rigorous as the testing is today. So it was happening, and I think a lot of us were aware of who was doing it. And I think the nice thing about being on the 7-Eleven team was we never had to make that decision, because right from the very beginning, Akowitz made it apparent that, you know, whether we did well or we did not do well, it didn't matter as long as we really kind of stayed on the straight and narrow with regards to doping. But what really changed cycling was when erythropoietin showed up, or EPO.
Yeah.
And that made some very dramatic changes. And unfortunately, early on, you could not test for it. And so, you know, with the pressures of being a professional and wanting to have a contract the next year, and a lot of that is based on your results, EPO really sort of infiltrated the peloton. And I think even today, it's one of those medications or doping medicines that still is very hard for the anti-dopers to detect.
Well, obviously there are a lot of controversy going on in the peloton in Europe, and it's wreaked havoc with a lot of these famous racers. I want to let you know that we're speaking with Dr. Eric Heiden. He's out in Park City, Utah, just one of the, you know, famous people in our business, you know, somebody I've looked up to for years and years and years and years. In your book, Faster, Better, Stronger, you talk about choosing the right sport for your body. I thought that was a pretty interesting idea. Can you tell me a little more about that?
Well, you know, when you think about some of the people who have been outstanding in their athletic career, a lot of them, whether they've appreciated it early on or not, have really sort of fallen into a sport that allows their physical abilities to shine. And when you think about cycling, the big thing you have to be is a very good aerobic or an endurance athlete. And that means, one, you have to be able to utilize oxygen well, which means that your lung function has to be very good. You also have to be gifted with the type of muscles that you have. You have to have sort of these muscles that are very attuned to aerobic activity. So those kinds of things will make you a good endurance athlete. Other athletes are very good power athletes and sprint athletes, and if they got involved with trying to race in the Tour de France, it would never happen.
I see. Okay, I get it.
So, you know, like someone like, oh, gosh, you know, just, you know, picking out an athlete, if you looked at somebody, say, like in basketball, one, you know, genetically, very often they have to have height. You cannot teach height. It's one of those things that comes
right
from mom and dad. And then you also have to have good eye-hand coordination. When you think about a cyclist racing the Tour de France, all those guys have very good ability to utilize oxygen. One way to measure that is max VO2. And all those guys have a VO2 max greater than basically 70. And that just kind of weeds those guys out. But if you ask them to hit a golf ball or, you know, eye-hand coordination type stuff, they'd be very challenged.
So what would the average person who isn't gifted in that way, what would that VO2 max be for, say, just your average person walking down the street who isn't able to be a Lance Armstrong or today, or you in your day?
Yeah, no, the average person probably has a VO2 max of between about 40, and the relatively active person maybe upwards of 50.
So that's a huge difference. You're talking like 40 to 50% difference.
It's a huge difference.
Oh, it's mammoth.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so, you know, you see a lot of people who try cycling early on in their in their life, but ultimately those kinds of genetic gifts sort of weed everybody out. And if you test everybody in the Tour de France, their VO2 max will be 70 or above, and that's what makes them so good.
Wow. See, so I didn't understand how VO2 max worked until now. Thank you very much. That was very cool. Now I understand that. So you are now an orthopedic surgeon, and you obviously had this in mind while you were cycling. There was something I read. Now you can say this is wrong. You actually used endorsement money to take yourself through medical school.
Yeah, I feel very lucky in that a lot of the things that I did after skating, the endorsements, there were not many, but the ones that I did allowed me to pay for my education, and I got out of undergraduate at Stanford and my medical school training at Stanford without any debt, which is very unusual.
I'll say. You know, we have a great medical school here, but I know people walk away wondering how the heck they're ever going to pay those giant bills back. And
yeah.
You became an orthopedic surgeon. Most of your patients are athletes or no?
No, I would even say a minority are athletes.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I take care of people. A lot of the people that I take care of are really, whether they appreciate it or not, are in a sense athletes. So you think about the manual laborers, the guys who are plumbers, the guys who are working on construction. Those guys, in some sense, are athletes who every day they're having to really stress their bodies. I take care of a number of people in the armed forces. And again, you know, they're very much like athletes. They ask a lot of their bodies. I do take care of a lot of the speed skaters living out in Park City. The national team is, their headquarters are out here, so I see a lot of them. We also see a lot of cyclists. There's a lot of masters athletes out here who have done very well in their professional career and now are kind of retired and spending a lot of time on bicycles or running and trying to explore their athletic ability.
So are you doing things like hip replacements and knee replacements and that kind of stuff? Or what kind of work exactly?
Yeah. So my subspecialty within orthopedics is what people would say is sports medicine. So I do a lot of arthroscopy, soft tissue repairs, ACL reconstructions.
Yeah.
I do a lot of knee replacements and also shoulder replacements. And the baby boomers who just, you know, kind of have...
That would be me.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So what cycling injuries do you see most often? And I could probably tell you being a professional bike fitter, but go ahead. I want to hear it from the surgeon.
Oh, I think probably the thing that causes people the most problems are their knees and their back. So you see a lot of overuse injuries. And a lot of those things, luckily, can be addressed without having to have any kind of surgery. But sometimes after you've explored all the other possibilities, which, you know, maybe changes in training regimes or maybe changing the way that you sit on your bicycle, very often you can address a lot of these overuse injuries. But I would tell you it's mostly sort of anterior knee pain and low back pain are probably the majority of the issues that we deal with. And then as an orthopedic surgeon, you see a lot of people who fall off their bike and break their collarbone.
Yes, we do, don't we? They hit those front brakes and down they go.
Down they go, or they hit a rock when they're mountain biking and boom.
So if the person is fit on the bike correctly, which of course is, again, that's my specialty and I see it a lot, have you seen a huge change given all the new materials and just the way bicycles are built today that there might be? It's like skis. Skis got faster and people didn't get as fast as the skis. Do you know what I mean? Are the bikes?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense. You know, very often when people come and visit and they have issues with either primarily back and knees, very often one thing I want to find out about is, their bike fit? Have they changed any of their equipment? You know, like shoes sometimes become an issue. Pedals become an issue. Sometimes somebody will get a bike sort of late in the season, and then it'll sit in the garage, and then in the spring they get out on that new bike and don't appreciate the fact that the minor little changes, the millimeter higher saddle or the millimeter lower saddle, can account for a lot of the problems that they're having. And then a lot of the bikes these days, not everybody will fit, one type of bike. Very often you got to find a bike that sort of fits your anatomy. And so some bike that is made by Specialized might not be as appropriate for you as a bike made by Trek.
Can I thank you right now for saying that? Well, because, it's one of the things that's difficult to get across to people, that how different bikes, the geometry makes such a difference, and then the fit on top of that makes a difference, and your cleats and all of that, and the saddle position and handlebars and all of that. So it's really good to hear somebody from the medical side, making note of things as important as 1 millimeter here and 1 centimeter there, and all of that does make a difference.
It makes a big difference.
Yeah.
And I bet you half the people who come to me after visiting with other orthopedic surgeons who have recommended surgery, very often I will send half of those patients home just going, look, think about maybe changing the pedals or put a shim underneath your cleat or change the crank arm length, those kinds of things.
That's awesome. I love it. I am so happy you're saying that. We are speaking with Dr. Eric Heiden out in Park City, Utah, one of the great athletes of our generation. And, I don't even want to ask you how old you are now.
I'm 52.
That's unbelievable. You were just a kid.
I know.
So do you have children?
I have two kids, ages 7 and 9, boy and a girl.
And do they are they athletes?
They participate in a lot of athletic activities. Right now the big ones are, coming up, we have skiing and snowboarding.
Right.
They play soccer. They do karate. They enjoy riding their bikes. They play tennis. So I'm letting them explore as many opportunities as they desire.
And your wife is in your practice with you?
Correct.
Yeah, she's a hand surgeon.
Yep.
Yes, I saw that.
Yeah, the two of us have really practiced alongside each other since we graduated from residency.
And are you still skating and or riding?
I enjoy skating. I don't skate like I used to, but my son plays a lot of hockey, and there's a pond near our house that freezes, and so I get out there and play pond hockey with him.
Okay.
And then cycling, I'm still addicted to cycling, and I try to get out on a bike or on my wind trainer probably 2 to 4 times a week.
So can I ask what kind of bike you're riding?
I work for BMC.
Okay.
So I have two very nice BMC bikes sitting in the garage, one that's all Super Record and one that's all Shimano.
Is it the DI2?
It is the SLOC. What is it? SLCO1? SLCO1, I think it's
the electronic shifting?
No, I don't have any electronic shifting.
Oh, it's very cool. You need to try it. You need to try it. It's very cool. Well, it's just been so cool to talk to you and to know that you're still out there doing all this stuff and we're willing to take some time. I know you are really busy and that this is one of your busy days. So I'd like to ask you to please have a wonderful holiday.
Thank you.
And to stay on the bike as long as you can. That's my recommendation, doctor.
That's my recommendation that I give to a lot of my patients.
Exactly. Well, I teach yoga, too, so I have people do that, too.
Good.
So we'll check in with you again. Say hello to your whole family, and I know Dr. Test is there, too.
Correct.
Have a great holiday.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
See ya. Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. Was he delightful? Just delightful. I am overwhelmed by how sweet he was.
That's very cool. Very cool. He's that, there's so many athletes, world-class athletes, that don't continue on being active like that later on in life. And obviously he's an exception to that. So that's very, very neat.
Well, what was really cool for me was, first of all, of course, he just reinforces all the things I say. So there's nothing like having somebody in your corner going, oh, yeah, that's what you should do.
Yeah.
And that he's just, he just is like such a regular guy. And
very
how
genuine.
About all the accolades he's given his sister.
Yeah.
We should probably talk to Beth. She, she's a pretty screaming athlete, too. I did a little bit of research when I was working on, you know, getting ready to talk to Eric about Beth, and she's out there with her kids racing.
Nice.
Yeah, it is. So maybe we'll talk to them.
He's right. So, you know, cycling I've found and fit on a bike is very subtle. And a lot of times it creeps up on you. You don't realize it until something starts to hurt. But it, because you can ride for a long distance with something a little bit out of whack, and it's not apparently obvious right
away.
Until
you get off the bike.
Well, or until you've gone, you know, more than 20 or 30 miles.
Oh, yeah.
Or just over time, even things change. You change, the bike changes.
Oh, yeah. If you gain 5 pounds or lose 5 pounds, or, you know, you've been off the bike for 6 months, you get back on, your muscles aren't the same.
Yeah.
You know, it's muscle memory that it sort of goes to sleep for a while.
Yeah.
So, and you know, I know your fit is a very subtle fit. We've done it a couple times.
I only wish that I had enough time to bike that I could risk an overuse injury. That ain't happening recently, unfortunately.
Yeah, no kidding.
All right, well, we've got to get out of here, but we've got
I thought I'd leave the banter between me and Greg Priddy, who was my co-host for a number of years. I think it rounded out the interview with Eric Heiden nicely. I'd like to thank Colin O'Brien for taking time to talk about his new book, The Beautiful Race, The Story of the Giro d'Italia. If you like history, especially cycling history, I think you'd enjoy this book. Published date is Tuesday, April 3rd, so if you're interested, get yours on order now. Next week, I'm hoping Rich Thompson from the William and Mary College Bike Alliance is feeling better and up to a conversation. I hope you and your families have a lovely holiday. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening. Ride safely, and we'll see you next week.